Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally and internationally, 7 days a week in more than 112 countries around the world over the internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on education versus indoctrination when we come back. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and a Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms, but what is it that government does to produce, to prepare, or to deliver, for which the government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, and 72% for a drink? Now, does the guy at the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on that pizza that they have to buy the ingredients to make, then they have to prepare it, and cook it, and serve it, and pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? So why does government get paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that we all buy? Well, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. Now, tax and status, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Let's do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about this thing of education and indoctrination. And I've been quoting some chapters and some sections out of a book called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. It was written by a fellow named Zach Montgomery. That's a Z-A-C-H, in case you're looking for the name. It's not Zachary. It's Zach, Z-A-C-H, Montgomery. He wrote the book back in 1886. That's 1886. That's more than 100 years ago. It was reprinted by the St. Thomas Press in 1968 and 1983. And last time, we were talking about the chapter that deals with A Voice from San Quentin. And I pointed out to you that we were reading in the story flow here that public school is an education in crime, that public school has a purpose and a motivation, and that's to destroy the family unit. Montgomery calls it the anti-parental school system. Now, lest you think, you know, you're coming in late in the story here, that we're opposed to education. We're not. I'm an educator, and I'm not opposed to education at all. And Zach Montgomery isn't opposed to education. He's opposed to bad education, faulty education, wrong education, but he's not opposed to education. And he pointed out that there was two systems of education extant in the United States: the New England model, which we have adopted nationwide and we practice today. It's called the New England model of anti-parental education. That is, the state steps in and they educate us, and to hell with the ideas and the beliefs and the philosophies and the education of your home, your family, your church, or anybody else. We're getting a state education. It's a secular education. It's a liberal arts education. Now, that's where we're at. And it's not just here in the United States, it's worldwide. And everywhere in the world is getting a secular education. Now, the opposite to that is a parental education. Now, a little later on, we'll take a look in the Bible. Now, God, the Creator, he's the guy that came up with the idea of universal education and compulsory education. So, if in your country or in your state or in your community, you have a law that requires that all children be educated, that came from God himself. He required them. So compulsory education is a requirement. The state requires it. God requires it. Now, God was a little different. He doesn't believe in the liberal arts education field. His program calls for a legal education, that everyone that comes out of the biblical educational system should be a lawyer or the equivalent thereto, that you should have a full grasp of the law, code pleading, cross-examination, and how to use it, a legal education. It isn't taught, at least here in the United States, it isn't being taught, because the people that have control of the Bible are the religious people, and they give their people a religious education. So the Baptists, they give a religious education to their followers. They indoctrinate them in their religion. It's not an education now, it's an indoctrination. So religion is an indoctrination program, just like the secular education program in public school is an indoctrination. It's not an education. If they were being educated, they would have a choice. Indoctrination does not leave anybody with any choice. This is the way it is. This is what you do. This is what you believe. This is what we believe. This is what you are. And you participate. And that's the end of the argument. Now, in the Bible, God presents to you this legal education, and it says you need to make a choice, son. In Deuteronomy 30, for example, he uses the word choose. And in a number of places, he says, now choose you this day who you're going to follow, me, or you want to follow Baal. That's what education is all about. Education is where we present information, and then you choose. Well, what do you want to do? Here's the good side of it. Here's the bad side of it. Here's the indifferent side of it. You know, life is made up of choices. Get after it. Make your choice. And that's what education is all about. Now, my old dad told me, he said, there's no better teacher than experience. No better teacher than experience. I've tested it. Let me tell you, I think he's right. But he warned me at the same time. He said, but son, it's a god-awful hard way to learn. And he advised me. He said, you know, every time you come up with one of your harebrained schemes with one of your pimply-faced punk friends, run it by me first and let me tell you how it came out when I tried it. And he said, life will be a lot easier for you if you do that. And I didn't always do that, but a couple times I did. And he was right. You know, he would say to me, well, that didn't work when I tried it. Or here's the result I got when I did it. And he was about right. I went out and tried it anyway. I got about the same result he did. And typically, that's what you're going to have. So in order to avoid being laughed at in advance or laughed at after you tried this crazy harebrained scheme, you know, like paper money. You see, paper money's been around for a long time. In the Bible, God tells us not to use unjust weights and balances. The paper money doesn't work. We didn't believe it. We tested it in this country in the colonial period, and it failed, and we had an average 90% loss. And sure enough, 1913 comes along. Paul Warburg blows into town and says, what you people need is a central bank like all the nations of Europe. And we said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And we adopted it. And here we are 100 years later, and we're getting the same results that the colonists got back in 1783, the total collapse of the economy. And the average loss of 90% of all of our wealth. And we're right on the cusp of it. Here's 2008, and the Great Depression of the 21st century has begun. It started in August. You know, just like the Great Depression of the 1930s started in October of 1929, we'll be able to look back here in 10 years and say, well, the Great Depression started in August of 2007. And then here's the results of it. We'll write the history. Now, it's a tragedy that we had to do it by experience because, you know, we've had plenty of warning, plenty of experience in the past dealing with this thing of unjust weights and balances, stocks and bonds and all the rest of it. But, you know, we had to learn. And so our experience with the coming Great Depression is going to be very, very valuable to all of us. Very valuable to all of us. We could not learn from the experience of our forefathers, and so we'll have to learn from our own experience. Now, education falls right into that. And this guy, Zach Montgomery, is pointing that out. He says, now listen, we've had educational experience that goes back for thousands of years. And the better educational experience that we have over here is education versus indoctrination. Now, around the 1880s, we woke up one day and we said, we don't want any more of this education crap. We want indoctrination. We want a secular education. We want a liberal arts education. Okay. Now, that's what you have in America, and in fact, that's what you have around the world. Okay, now, most of us have never had an education. We have had an indoctrination, and therefore, we don't have any way to measure our indoctrination against any potential education. We've never had that experience. So, here's a guy comes along and says, well, let me write you a story here. I'm going to tell you a story, and this is where we're at right now. We're talking about a laborer over here who has just educated his 6 children in the public school, and he has scrimped, and he has saved, and he has gone without. And now his son, his oldest son, has a high school diploma in 1886 in San Francisco, California. So let's pick up the story where we left it off last time. And here's what it says. After years of study, he at length, that is the eldest son, completes his course at the Lincoln High School, acquitting himself with great honor. Amidst the cordial congratulations of professors and school directors and eliciting the vociferous applause of the admiring multitude. You know, it's graduation. Graduation. Somebody comes up here and gives you a BS speech that does mean jack diddly squat and tells you how smart you are and how a great decision you made when you went to high school, when you went to college. We may imagine that we see his poor old father crouching on the outskirts of the crowd, feasting his eyes upon an occasional glimpse of his son, but not daring to approach his son because he has no clothes fit to be seen on such an occasion as graduation. Doubtless, that father is picturing to himself a brilliant future for his son. He is perhaps looking forward to the day when his son shall be the governor of the state, or perhaps a senator, or even possibly president of the United States, like Barack Obama, maybe. Very likely, too, he fancies that in his declining years he shall be able to look to his son for that assistance and support which his own exhausted means may then refuse to afford him. But alas, how baseless are all of these castles in the air. The day after quitting school, the young man finds himself for once thrown on his own unaided resources. And his father says to him, well, my son, I have been a long time struggling with poverty and want in order that you might become educated. You see that both your mother and I are in rags, and that handsome suit which you now wear is yet to be paid for. You now have a fortune tied up in your education, and hereafter you must learn to shift for yourself, and if possible, lend a helping hand from time to time to the support of your younger brothers and sisters. So, that's where we left off last time. Thus situated, the young man, now newly graduated from high school, probably for the first time in his whole life, now asks himself seriously this question. What business is he now going to follow? A more appropriate question should be, what business can he follow? Because there he stands in the midst of a great bustling city, without a cent of money at his command, without any friends, without occupation, and without the necessary qualifications for any earthly employment within his reach. Probably his first effort will be to find a position as a clerk in some bank or other business establishment. But he soon learns that these positions are all filled by the sons of wealthy or influential parents. Occasionally, he meets a former schoolmate discharging the duties of some coveted place, but on inquiry, he learns that he has obtained his position at the instance of a wealthy father or an influential friend. So, failing in everything else, the son now at length seeks for copying as a means of earning bread. So he gets hold of a city directory and he makes a list of the names and locations of all of the law offices in the city. He then goes from office to office in quest of the only work that he really knows how to do. After all, he can read and write. But everywhere he goes, he is forestalled. Everywhere he is doomed to disappointment. Now he learns about unemployment. On every hand, he meets young men and boys similarly situated and making similar fruitless efforts to raise a few dimes with which to stave off starvation. Already, the boy has spent weeks in an earnest but vain endeavor to find work as a copyist. In the meantime, he has been living partly on his old father and partly on what he could pick up at the free lunch tables. Seeing the son's extreme embarrassment, the father perhaps suggests to him that inasmuch as he has been disappointed in everything else, that maybe he had better come and help him lay down these cobblestones on Battery Street, where he can at least earn enough money to buy victuals and clothes. Ah, but alas, the young man's hands are wholly unused to toil. And what is infinitely worse, he has been, as we before said, so trained up in the school system as to despise both manual labor and manual laborers. I'm going to pause here and point out, I've got a son just like that. Nice boy. I like him. But that kid has been trained up in the colleges, and he absolutely hates manual labor. And I don't know that he hates manual laborers. I think he likes me because I go out and milk the cow. I go out and gather the eggs. I go out and feed the cows, you know, when it's snowing and ice, while my boy stays comfortably in the house where it's warm, working on his computer. But I want to point out, I had a woman here, not a young woman, she's a middle-aged woman, came to our $100,000 school, and after two or three days, she left with her husband and went back home. And some of the other students asked why, and I said, I don't know. Occasionally that happens. People will come to school here, and they learn rapidly that this isn't for them, and so they leave. That's the choice that you have in education. See, we're not running an indoctrination school here. You're free to leave anytime you want. And one of the students in class said, oh, I know why she left. She and her husband, why they left. And so we all inquired, well, what did she tell you? She said, this weeding in the gardening is degrading. This woman, in her entire life, had never done manual work. And when we put her to work in the garden at the lowliest manual labor there is in the garden, that is, weeding, in the hot sun, bent over, sweat pouring off of her face, she said, this is degrading. I want to go back to my office, which is air-conditioned, where I can work and earn money and go down to the grocery store and buy my Brussels sprouts and broccoli. I do not want to work. Now, that's what educated people learn. That's why the Amish people want to jerk their children out of public school. They don't want their children in public school. That's why they operate their own private schools. And then when the child gets to be in the eighth grade or finishes eighth grade, they jerk them out and put them to work in the garden so they can learn to do something productive, something that's meaningful, something that produces something that we need in the community. Boys and girls, geologists, archaeologists, and paleontologists are as useless as tits on a boar hog. Now, it's nice to know that we have an archaeologist who went out and dug up some old ruins and told us a neat story and put the artifacts in the museum. I like to go to the museum and I like to look at the artifacts, but the only reason that we can afford to do that is because we have Amish men and women who are out in the gardens, out in the fields, growing our food for us. Because without them, we would all starve to death. That's the bottom line. You see, boys and girls, those of us that are educated, those of us that can read and write, those of us that work in the cities in air-conditioned offices, do not produce any useful, productive goods or services for the community. Now, what we're producing may be fun. You know, it's like going to Six Flags. God, that's a lot of fun riding on the roller coaster. But, boys and girls, mankind's been on planet Earth for several thousand years, and we lived comfortably without roller coasters. We have never lived well without food. Never. Never before, we aren't now, and never will. And the people that produce that food and fiber for us, those people that produce those useful, productive, and meaningful things like houses and homes and offices and factories and food and fiber are the necessary backbone of any civilized society. I mean, that's just the way life is. We have to have food, clothing, and shelter. And the people that produce that food, clothing, and shelter are the people who are useful and productive and meaningful in the society. It's nice to know that we can educate people to be paleontologists so that we can go down to the paleontology store and buy dinosaur bones and listen to nice stories about dinosaurs. You know, like listening to Goldilocks and the Three Bears. But we can't live on that. Now he goes on and says, he would be ashamed for one of his school companions to even meet him walking the street in company with his own father because of the old man's horn-like palms and his laborer's dress. So that even if he knew how to work, still in view of the fact that he was only the other day that he finished his educational course with so much eclectic and amidst such a shower of bouquets as rained around him from the fair hands of San Francisco's wealth and beauty. Is it to be expected that he is now going to have and heave cobblestones on a public street here under the very shadow of his alma mater, to be twitted and jeered by those who envied him the literary honors with which he came loaded from the Lincoln School? No, no, that is utterly impossible. Propose anything but that. Yet, says he, something must be done, and that must be done soon. I must have clothes, and I must have bread. The world owes me a living, and I intend to have it. Thus saying, he turns his back upon his humble and destitute home and betakes himself again to perambulating the streets ready for any desperate turn in events that promises him any money. Now let the reader pause here and ask himself this question. What is there to save this youth from becoming a pest to society, a disgrace to his old father and mother, and finally a convicted felon doomed to serve the state within its penitentiary walls? Well, perhaps it will be claimed that the bare recollection of this newly acquired literary honors and the fear of losing the esteem of those who the other day so vociferously applauded his youthful oratory and threw at his feet such a profusion of flowers ought of itself to be sufficient to shield him from temptation's harm. But unfortunately, those withered flowers will not serve for food, nor can he make clothes either of approving smiles or shouts of applause. But can it be possible, you say, that one so young, so intelligent, so well-educated has no respect for the law? Why, sir, if you talk to him about respecting the law, he will laugh you to scorn. Who is it that respects the law, he will say, except just so far as the law subserves his purposes? Have we not laws against bribery? And yet do not even our lawmakers on election day send out their dirty minions with money in their pockets with which to buy their way into the very halls of legislation? What? Are not seats in the United States Senate sometimes bought with gold? And does not even the election of a United States president often depend more upon successful lying, frauds, and bribery than upon the people's honest votes? Then why prat to me, the young man says, about the sanctity of the law, when the very men who make the laws trample them unceremoniously under their feet whenever it suits their purpose? But you will say, if this youth has no regard for human law, surely he cannot be wholly indifferent to the laws of God. Well, be not so fast there, my dear sir. Have you forgotten that the boy was educated in our public schools, where it is a criminal offense punishable by a forfeiture of all interest in the public school monies, to even mention the subject of the Bible or the Ten Commandments within the hearing of a student? And do you know that there is no such prohibition against inculcating the horrible doctrines of atheism in these same public schools? Now that many of our public school teachers are avowed atheists who believe neither in God nor the devil, neither in hell nor heaven, and that our young hero is a firm believer in these dismal and diabolical doctrines. Well, very true, you say. I knew very well that no religion was allowed to be taught in the public schools, but then why did not his father and mother teach him religion at home? We first answer the question by asking another, and it is this. How do you know that his parents themselves had any well-defined notions of religion, or in fact any religion at all? And if his parents had firmly believed in the teachings even of that natural religion, which an almighty hand has written in indelible characters on every human heart, they surely would never have consented to surrender to the public at large the right to select the teachers, and in all essential particulars to shape the mental and moral as well as the physical destinies of their own child, would they? But let us suppose that his parents were in every other particular real models of perfection. Let us suppose both in their professions and in their practices of religion, was it to be expected that he, their son, would accept religious instruction from them? After all, are not his parents illiterate? And is not he educated? And shall wisdom take lessons from ignorance? Has he not learned to despise them both for their poverty and for their simplicity? Can it be doubted that even the sacrifices which they made in his behalf, that the very patches with which they mended their old garments in order that he might be handsomely dressed to attend school, that the very toils and hardships which his parents have in their wrinkled brows soiled their features and imparted the bony touch of their palms in order that he, their eldest son, might learn to read and write and to lead a life of ease and freedom from manual labor? Aren't all of these, on his part, requited with coldness and contempt? And after learning to despise his parents, is it at all likely that he would profit either by their religious instruction or their praiseworthy example? No, no. Their religion, just like their toilsome lives and their old clothes, may be good enough for them, but not to an educated young man like himself. It is only a bundle of cumbersome and useless rubbish, and he will have none of it. Then, since our young hero has learned to respect neither the laws of man nor the laws of God, and will neither be directed by the good counsels nor influenced by the exemplary lives of his own father and mother, where, then, let it be asked, shall we look for the controlling power that is to shape his future destinies? Just follow him along as he hurries along yonder busy street, and you will see. Already he is in company with half a dozen of his late schoolmates, each of whom has a tale of woe and disappointments to tell, quite like his own. Now, for the first time since leaving school, each and all of these boys find themselves in congenial society. They feel that the world cares nothing for them, and they care nothing for the world. They all have empty stomachs and seedy clothes, and there is not money enough in the crowd to purchase even one night's lodging at the meanest lodging house in the city. One of the party suggests that, having failed in everything else, he has an idea of making an effort to get a position as dishwasher in some hotel, or, failing in that also, he might seek employment as stable boy to clean out the stalls of some livery stable. The majority of his companions, however, frown upon the proposition with contemptuous indignation, and our hero threatens never hereafter to speak to the low-bred rascal should he ever again be guilty of advancing a proposition so far beneath the dignity of an educated gentleman. In order, however, to put at rest the question as to the feasibility of finding even that kind of employment, one little fellow, the smallest in the crowd, puts in a word to assure his companions that there is not enough in the last suggestion to be worth quarreling about. He says he has been for the past 3 days and a good part of the nights hunting from house to house, both in public hotels and private dwellings, for any kind of light work such as boys could do, and everywhere he has found the field already occupied, most always by Chinamen. Whereupon they all agree that they could not if they would, and would not if they could, enter into any successful competition with Chinamen for the honor of discharging the menial duties of either stable boys or kitchen servants. So at this particular juncture, one of the party suggests that his old widowed aunt has $500 in gold 20s buried under her barn floor, and that he knows just where to find the cash. They can get this money, and nobody but themselves need be any the wiser for it. He says she has plenty without that, and she is such a stingy old hag that it would be serving her just right for them to go and relieve her of that $500. We do not propose to follow this little band of young hoodlums further for the present. But if any friend of our present public school system can discover any motive which will deter from crime and preserve from the penitentiary any one of the hundreds upon hundreds of our city's youths whose education and situation in life differ in no essential particular from that of the boys just above described, he will, by pointing out such a motive, unquestionably confer a great and lasting benefit both on the rising generation and on society at large. From the fate of the eldest boy of our poor laborer, we shall leave the reader to guess the doom which awaits this young man and his younger brothers and sisters. All right, let's pause here and let's analyze what we've just seen. But before we do that, let me give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and the editorial review may be hostile. They could be political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. It was put out by a fellow named Zach, Z-A-C-H, Montgomery. I don't know whether you can find a copy of the book or not. We'll do our best here to help you if we can. It's called The School Question, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, Parental and Non-Sectarian Standpoint, or From a Parental and Non-Sectarian Standpoint. It's an epitome of the educational views of Zach Montgomery, on account of which views a stubborn but fruitless effort was made in the United States Senate to prevent his confirmation as Assistant Attorney General. So he had been appointed, or had been nominated, for the position of Assistant Attorney General, and the Senate turned him down. They said, this guy is anti-school. So he wrote a book. And then he said, yep, that's exactly correct. I am anti-public school, and here's why. Now, this book was first published by Gibson Brothers Printers and Bookbinders. That's Gibson Brothers Printers and Bookbinders in 1886. Then it was reprinted by the St. Thomas Press. St. Thomas Press, Post Office Box 35096, Houston, Texas, and the zip code was 77235. The first printing was in 1968, and the second printing was in 1983. That was reprinted by the St. Thomas Press, Post Office Box 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. All right, let's see if that'll help you get a copy of it. Now, let me make a comment here. I said we'd review this. Can you remember a fellow by the name of Ken Lay? Ken Lay. He's dead now, but he used to run an outfit called Enron. Enron was one of the biggest energy companies in America. And Ken Lay and his cohorts, all educated in the business schools, you know, Harvard and Yale and Princeton and so on, they perpetrated a fraud against the people of California. And they sold electric power and screwed the people of California out of billions of dollars. Not millions, just billions and billions of dollars. And then he went on later to bankrupt his company, the Enron company, and screw the stockholders and the employees out of more billions and billions of dollars. And here's a man educated in the public school system, educated in the colleges, the universities. But he didn't have the kind of education that this fellow Zach Montgomery is describing. The kind of education that the people that we call Amish have. Because the Amish people are not screwing you people in California out of billions of dollars. They're not in a position to do so. But even if they were, I don't think they would. Now, as I speak, down in Texas, there's a legal confrontation going on. You see, the state of Texas came in to a small religious sect down there of Mormons. And they said, these people are practicing polygamy, underage marriage. And what we need to do down here is to go in here and clean out this boar's nest and straighten out this filthy den of immorality. So the state social ladies went in there and they took 436 children out of their families and put them in foster homes. And now the mothers and fathers of these children are trying to get them back. They won't. They will not get them back. And the state is going to take those children, put them into foster homes, and educate them in public school. Now, all of these children are being educated in their own little local schools in this compound, in this religious sect, this little group of people over here. And you can rest assured that in this little religious sect, this little group, these 436 children, not a single one of them is on marijuana, cocaine, or heroin. You can rest assured that by the time the state completes their education, a certain number of them will be on those drugs, illegal drugs. And just as Mr. Montgomery here has pointed out, the secular liberal arts education that is being foisted off on all of us worldwide. We don't care where you're at, in Brazil or the Seychelles Islands or wherever you're at. you can rest assured that your politicians and your government have adopted this educational model. And in this educational model are the seeds of all of these social ills, unemployment. These people will be taught in these public schools that manual labor is wicked and evil and you ought not to engage in it. That's why social ladies are social ladies, because they could not go out and weed the garden. Now, Amish ladies can go out and weed the garden. Social ladies cannot, and they will not. Now, you can rest assured that policemen and others, firefighters and others that work in the public sector, work for government, they don't go out and produce their food and fiber. They cannot, and they will not. After all, that's below their dignity. After all, they're firemen and policemen, they're professionals, doctors and lawyers and paleontologists and archaeologists. Those people don't grow their fruits and vegetables now. That's done by the Amish. That's done by the low class. That's done by Mexicans, Chinamen. It's done by Amish men. It's done by people who are the poorest in our society, the people that are the blue-collar workers. Not the Kinleys now, not the Enrons, not the college graduates. Those people, they make their livings off the backs of the working class. And this is the crux of the problem. Because as time progresses along in civilization and society, there's a limit to how many parasites can be supported by that working class. And in America today, 51% of Americans are drawing some form of government check. So that tells us that half the people of America are now living at the government trough. You know, they're eating upon the mountains, as we see in Ezekiel 18. Now, that process is wonderful for the parasites. You know, a tick needs a dog's ear to live. But the dog does not need the parasite. A dog can live his life happily without a tick, without a parasite. But the parasites all have to have a host. And so if you take a look at our society here in the United States, we find that we have a lot of parasites. Paleontologists, archaeologists, geologists, public school teachers, and all of you people out there listening to me right now that make your livings based upon your education, you're all parasites, every single one of you. You cannot live without the working class that produces your food and fiber. In fact, here in America, it is so bad that half of our food now comes from overseas. I want to point out to you that there was a time in America when Americans were self-sufficient. We could work. You know, we could milk cows. Americans could weed the garden. Americans could produce their own food. But that isn't true in 2008, and is evidenced by the fact that half the food that you consume in your supermarket is now coming from outside your borders. Boys and girls in America, that spells disaster for you. Famine is coming upon you, like the prodigal son. Now, you don't see that now because you've been educated. But your education did not include the instruction from Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, Rome, Greece, Athens, Sparta. You didn't learn from those failed civilizations and societies. They all practice the same thing we're practicing right now. Now, the entire world is about to go into a worldwide depression like we did in the 1930s. This is brought upon us by our economic policies that we learned in our schools and universities, that we were all educated to, that we all believe in, that we all love, that we all practice, stocks and bonds and negotiable instruments and adjustable rate mortgages and usury and interest. It has never worked in the past, it is not working now, and it is not likely to work in the future. And we were told that. Had we received a legal education from our Bible, from our God, we would have sat back and said, wait a minute, this hasn't worked in the past. Maybe we ought not to try that now. But we didn't. We all went to public school. And they told us, do not listen to the Bible. Do not listen to these religious nuts. You listen to your liberal arts education. You listen to your teachers and your professors. And I remember when I went to school, I brought that up one time to my ag teacher. And I said, my mentor, Frank Rocha, told me never put money in the bank. Never trust the banks. And here's the ag teacher. He said, well, that could have been true back in the Depression years. Now remember, this is in 1955, 56, long enough. And that might have been true back in the Depression years. Now how far back were the Depression years from 1956? 20 years ago, 1936, 1946, 1956. Now how old is my ag teacher? He's probably 30 years old. Go back 20 years. He was 10 years old in 1936. What in the hell does he know about the Great Depression or the closings of the banks or Franklin D. Roosevelt? Nothing. Nothing more than he learned from his teachers when he went to public school, that Franklin D. Roosevelt was the savior of America. All right, so he taught the entire class, and he said, we've got federal deposit insurance. Why we've got governmental agencies in place now to prevent that. Okay. Rely upon your governmental agencies. Rely upon your banks. Rely upon your Ben Bernanke's and your Henry Paulson's and your Wall Street bankers, all educated in these universities and colleges like Ken Lay, who screwed you out of billions of dollars in California. Go ahead. Rely upon them. Trust them. My God, if you can't trust your banker, who can you trust? And then come back to me in 10 years and tell me how that worked out. I'd be curious. I'd be interested. I hope to be here over the next 10 years so I can watch and witness and observe this myself. It hasn't worked in the past, it isn't working now, and my prediction is it's not likely to work in the future. Go ahead and elect Barack Obama, and let's see how he handles the Great Depression of the 21st century. Go ahead. Let me watch it. I think he's gonna do just about like every other politician in the past. He's gonna follow instructions, and he's gonna talk a lot when it gets right down to where push comes to shove. He's not gonna solve any more problems than Franklin D. Roosevelt did, which was exactly zero. Zero. Bottom line. Now, there was a solution. There is a solution. Even today, right now, today, there is a solution to the Great Depression. And the people who are following the scripture, following their education, their legal education, will probably come through this thing a lot better than you educated people. I was talking to an old-timer here around this neighborhood over here, chit-chatting a little bit over here, you know, at the DX station. And I said, he's an old man down here. I said, back during the Depression years, how'd things work out? And he said, well, he's slow talking, hillbilly. He said, well, I reckon we didn't really notice much difference because everybody here was so damn poor before the Depression that when the Depression struck, we couldn't notice much difference because you couldn't get no poorer. And, you know, I thought about that for a minute, and I said, you know, these old hillbillies around here were working, providing their own livings, and they were a lot poorer than their city cousins. And when their city cousins lost their shirts in the stock market and they lost their jobs and were out selling apples on the streets, the ordinary people here in the Ozarks were still out milking their cows, picking the fruit off the trees, weeding their gardens. They were subsistence farmers then, they're subsistence farmers now, and they never noticed that there was any problem. Now you take a Ken Lay, and you take away his millions. Well, that poor guy, he can't work. Why, he'd be ashamed to go out and weed the garden. I told you about this lady, she left here. She was ashamed to weed the garden. She was ashamed of manual labor. Why is that? Now I'm an old man, and I go out and I work every day. I build fence, and I weed in the garden. I cut dead wood out of the fruit trees, I prune, and whatever needs to be done. And that's because the skills that we all need for the three basics of life, that's food, clothing, and shelter, everybody should be able to provide for himself. Then if there's enough left over that gives you enough latitude that you can go out and spend your time in the museum, listening to the paleontologists and the archaeologists and the geologists tell their stories, that's great. That adds to your standard of living. It adds to your life's experience, and God bless all those paleontologists and all those archaeologists. But I wanted to point out that in the course of life, when it's all said and done, the Everett Chisholms and the Amish, the Mennonites, and the Dukhobors will still be here to propagate and to repopulate the world in the years to come. And the archaeologists and the paleontologists and the geologists will all become extinct because they simply do not have the means to survive. That's the bottom line. Now, that's been the history of the world up until now. You take a look at the history of the Babylonian Empire and ask yourself, how did the Babylonian Empire fare, and where is it today, and how is it functioning today? You know, it's out of business, been out of business for thousands of years, and hell, the average Joe Sixpack couldn't even tell you where it existed, when it existed, or how. The average couldn't tell you that. And that's because he has this liberal arts education. Now, the practical people around us that have the parental education, not the legal education from the Bible, but the parental education, those are the Amish and the Mennonites. Those are the Mormon sects. I want to touch on that for a moment. Let me ask you this question. The Mormons that are down there under investigation down in Texas, they were practicing, this is what the state's alleging, they're practicing underage marriage. That is, they've got young girls that are being married to husbands, and they're under 16 years of age. Would you do me a favor? Look in the Bible. Would you please? Look in the Bible and show me what the minimum marriageable age for a female is in Scripture. Where did God put in there that the age of 16, 18, 25, show me that age? Could you do that, please? The Virgin Mary was 17 when she had her first baby, Jesus. I don't know if that's too young. I haven't got a clue. I looked in the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. I couldn't find any minimum age for marriage. In fact, I can show you a number of examples throughout history where marriages have been arranged in royal families between six-year-olds, for crying out loud. Hell, they weren't even old enough to consummate the marriage, and yet they were married. And I'd like you to write me a letter and explain to me why it is that in the public schools of Texas, it's okay to teach a 14-year-old girl that she should have sexual relations with little Bobby, the 14-year-old boy, but that it's illegal and bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil for a 14-year-old girl to be married and have sexual relations within the sanctity of marriage. Now, can you explain that one to me? I'd like you to, if you would, please. And then I would like you to, this is your homework assignment here, boys and girls, I want you to look in the Bible, and I want you to show me the prohibition, all you good Baptists out there, show me the prohibition against polygamy. Show me where God said, polygamy is bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil, and you ought not to do it, and if you do, I'll throw you into hell for eternity. Can you do that for me? And then bear in mind that Jacob had four wives and David had six. In fact, David, King David, was given the wives, plural, from King Saul. Then he had three of his own, six wives. And he's called a man after God's own heart. God himself was a polygamist, says so plainly. He was married to both Israel and Judah. And he divorced Israel, and Judah killed him. So much for God's practicing polygamy. I said I point that out because we have morality in Texas and social lady, and the state of Texas is applying the morality of the state of Texas against this religious group down there because they're practicing underage marriage, which is not prohibited in the scripture, and they are prohibiting polygamy, which is not prohibited in the scripture. That's the morality of the state of Texas. I don't know if it's good, bad, right, or wrong, or indifferent, but I'd like to ask you this. How does this little group of Mormons in Texas impacting upon you by practicing their religious beliefs and practices, how has that been detrimental to you in Seattle, Washington? How has that been detrimental to any of you people living in Houston, Texas, or Dallas? They watched those people for 4 years before they could find a single accusation against them. It took 4 years for them to find an accusation. And now they have the social ladies down there taking the children out of those families and putting them into foster homes. Well, what in the hell is that going to do to strengthen the stability of the family unit? How does that work? Now, it's pretty obvious that you people in Texas are going to determine the morality of the people of Texas. And by God, you're not going to have polygamy, and you're not going to have underage marriage. But you're going to have underage, that is, 14-year-old girls and boys having sexual education. You're going to have 14-year-old boys learning an alternative lifestyle, learning how to practice sodomy and bestiality from the teachers in your public school, and that's your morality. I got news for you, children. There's a God in heaven, and he says, I ain't going to put up with that crap forever. There's a point in time when that's going to come to an end in Texas. All right, I'm out of time. Let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. Hey, time's up. I got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.